Thank you. Please be seated. In the past few years, St. John's College has made a special effort to include economics in study groups, preceptorials, and public lectures so that our community can reflect on the many approaches and consequences of this important subject. Tonight, we continue that effort in hosting Dr. William Peirce as our lecturer. Dr. Peirce is Professor Emeritus at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio, where he was chairman of the economics department for 6 years. He received his bachelor's degree from Harvard University, his PhD from Princeton University. He has specialized in public finance and industrial and energy economics. He has published several books, including Bureaucratic Failure and Public Expenditure, and Technological Progress and Industrial Leadership, along with numerous articles on a wide range of topics in economics. And we just learned tonight at dinner that in 2006, Dr. Peirce threw his hat into the political arena and ran for governor of the state of Ohio as the candidate for the Libertarian Party. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Peirce.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. I first heard about St. John's College in fall of 1955 when I was looking for a place to do my undergraduate work. And I was really intrigued by the program here until I heard my father mutter under his breath, kids go all over the country to get an education, they could just stay a little closer to home. And so I hopped on my bicycle and went to Harvard. And I learned bits and pieces of what is in your curriculum. And I guess I've spent the last 50 years or more trying to piece in the rest of it. My talk is, can taxes be fair? Should they be? And, you know, it's probably a little presumptuous to take on a topic like that. After all, people spend their lives working on the concept of fairness, and on the, people spend their lives working on taxes. And I'm trying to combine them all in the next 50 minutes or so, so hold on to your seats. But we'll do it. It's an intriguing topic because fairness is talked about all the time. I mean, you hear there's an organization dedicated to the fair tax. There are books about the fair tax. We have a president who talks about the rich should pay their fair share, which means more than it would be under the fair tax. You think, well, of course, if you do study public finance someday, you will find a lot of attention given to vertical equity and horizontal equity, which are the modern economist ways of talking about fairness. And yet, if you look at older literature, you don't find that. You don't find fairness at all in juxtaposition with taxation. Completely different areas. And the older literature is more inclined to use terms like intolerable, confiscatory, maybe old, maybe new, but fairness seems to have entered the tax discussion with maybe the Enlightenment, let's say the period leading up to the French and American revolutions, to give you some idea of how I'm dating things. And if I talk about modern, I'm talking about that era, and if I talk about old, it's before that. But when I told some friends that I was going to be talking about fairness and taxation, the kind of reaction I got was lots of luck. And they were looking at it from the perspective of people who have worked in the tax field for some time and know that practical reformers of taxation always learn that the the fare tax is defined by the old saying, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that guy behind the tree. Now let's see what else we can find out about it. First, let me sketch an earlier view of taxation, and now I want to put you back about 1,000 years or maybe more. And imagine yourself in a squalid village surrounded by wilderness. You and your neighbors are engaged in this daily struggle to scrape together dinner. A cloud of dust appears on the horizon, followed by the thunder of galloping hooves. Villagers scramble to hide from the gang of roving bandits who will kill, rape anyone they see, steal whatever they can carry, set fire to the rest, and gallop off. The surviving villagers wait a fair interval and then crawl out of their hiding places, try to piece together their squalid existence before winter sets in, knowing full well that the next gang of bandits may gallop in at any time. All right, what's wrong with this situation? Put yourself in the position of the bandits. After all, history is written by the winners. You ride for days through the wilderness, you risk the perils of attacking and plundering, and have very little to show for the effort because squalid villages provide scant booty. Eventually, the more perceptive roving bandits realize that by settling in a village as stationary bandits and protecting the inhabitants against other marauders, they can induce the villagers to work harder, accumulate capital, produce more, and provide them with more loot than they could extract by pure plunder. The stationary bandits might even evolve into government by providing internal law and order, judging disputes, defending property rights, converting indiscriminate looting into predictable taxes, and providing the public goods that increase production and hence tax revenues, roads, bridges, irrigation, training in useful skills, etc. Although the villagers become safer and more comfortable when the roving bandits evolve into stable government, there is no doubt that the government is an alien power extracting surplus from the people. Taxes are not fair or unfair, they're tolerable or oppressive. A good king is somebody who understands that arbitrary exactions and high tax rates do not yield as much revenue as more moderate and predictable rates that allow his subjects to prosper. The story with which you're probably more familiar is from 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel judged Israel, but when he was old and his sons were corrupt, the people requested a king like all the nations. After consulting with the Lord, Samuel explained what kings were like. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots, and he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be perfumers and to be cooks and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. Note, that's what land reform has been like for the last 5,000 years. He'll take your fields and vineyards and give them to his servants. That's Zimbabwean land reform, we refer to that. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. Again, the picture is that of an outsider who takes whatever he wants from his subjects. Fairness is not an issue. The alien power did not always settle in the subject territory. The Roman Empire and many others extracted tribute from the weaker nations, often local agents, the hated publicans of the Bible, would be granted the tax franchise for a particular area. Each agent was responsible for paying the contractual amount to the government, but could keep whatever he could squeeze out of the populace. This ancient device of tax farming persisted in some form for many centuries, which suggests the value of using someone with local and particular knowledge to estimate what the government could extract from taxpayers. The problems with authorizing an agent of government to squeeze an arbitrary amount from the taxpayers have led most commentators to condemn any practice that puts revenue agents on commission. The details of the taxes and forms of government varied from place to place and time to time, but from the view of the masses of mankind, there really wasn't much difference. The masses could expect that nearly all the surplus above subsistence would be extracted from them either as taxes or as rents to a landlord. When taxes became intolerable, the masses were squeezed to the point where population would actually be decreasing from malnutrition or because people fled from the high-tax civilization to take refuge with the barbarians outside. Even before the great invasions of Rome in the 5th century, central control of the Roman Empire had weakened, and as taxes on farmland were raised to the point where small farmers abandoned their plots, the large landowners absorbed smaller plots and became the feudal lords who contended with each other and with kings for power and taxes through the Middle Ages. Much of the political history focuses on barons, dukes, princes, and kings, but the maneuverings of that kind made little difference to the mass of mankind. Nevertheless, the concept of justice in taxation, as distinct from fairness, was developing. The teachings of the church became significant. God will certainly punish anyone who reinstates an old tax, Pope Gregory pointed out in about 600. New taxes also were forbidden by the Edict of Paris in 614. And it was expected that an exactio in audita, an unheard of tax, would provoke divine retribution. Kings would often have to ask the barons for special assistance to fund wars. This was generally granted for defensive wars, but not for offensive expeditions, which were expected to be self-financing through plunder and tribute. Montesquieu cites a number of contracts between kings and cities or particular populations, setting, among other matters, the taxes that could be levied on the city or group. These examples were from the 7th through the 12th centuries in Western Europe, when the king, however limited the geographic extent of his kingdom, was the highest earthly power until usurped or conquered. Yet kings did feel bound by their contracts. Whether this was evidence of fear of eternal retribution, some innate feeling of ethics, or a pragmatic calculation of the value of being known to keep one's word, or some combination of these, the result was to strengthen an ideal of justice in taxation that involved stability, predictability, and appropriateness. Today, just is often used as a synonym for fair, but the medieval concept is more closely related to the idea of being fitting, proper, and lawful. In Plato's Republic, the potter should not be paid either too much or too little because only the optimum pay would result in the maximum production of high-quality pots. It's purely an efficiency rule. It has nothing to do with fairness. Aristotle, when talking about the virtue of magnificence, described the contributions that a man should make to his community. They should reflect his wealth and station in life, being neither too cheap and tawdry nor too extravagant. For example, a very rich man might present a well-equipped naval vessel to his city. Someone with less wealth could offer a good banquet to the poor of the city. Of course, these ideas of voluntary contributions are not totally unheard of. You may have been in a college building that had somebody's name on it. You may have heard of the agreement of Bill Gates to give away half or most of his fortune before he dies. Perhaps they're related to self-assessment of the kind that Jonathan Swift talked about, where He calculated that all the revenues of a city could be derived by simply having men assess themselves on the basis of their own estimate of their own virility and women assessing their own beauty. But by the time of Aquinas, toward the end of the 13th century, when Aristotle's works entered the mainstream of Western scholarship, that version of justice in taxation was firmly established. That is, the individual's contribution to the community should be somehow proportionate to the wealth and standing of the individual. Despite that, King Louis XIV of France, who lived from 1638 to 1715, is reputed to have responded to reports that people were complaining about high taxes by stating, "It's all mine anyway, I can take whatever I want." Definitely a throwback to the plunder of roving bandits. In stark contrast, the roughly contemporaneous words of John Locke in 1690 define the new intellectual atmosphere. "Every man has a property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his." That leaves no room for slavery or feudalism, and room only for those taxes to which he has consented. At this stage, reached in different countries at different times, it becomes possible and probably useful to speak of fairness in taxation, but the concept presupposes the existence of a surplus above subsistence for the masses, a surplus that is not considered to be rightfully the property of landowners or governments, but rather belongs to the individuals who create it by their labor. This rough and impressionistic notion of a real divide in the way intellectuals perceive the world is borne out by a careful study by Alfani and Frigeni, published this year. They analyzed manuscripts and printed documents from about 1100 to 1830, centering on northern Italy. They found that people were aware of the vast disparities of wealth throughout the period, but in the earlier years considered it acceptable and a natural part of God's given order. This is consistent with Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas. Beginning in the 16th century, they find signs of individuals in a state of nature with freedom and equality, consistent with Grotius, Hobbes, and Locke. To put it bluntly, the atmosphere shifted from the regal, "Why do they complain about taxes? It's all mine," to the individualistic, "What right do those bandits have to plunder any of my hard-earned wealth?" But regardless of the shifts in intellectual climate, practical administrators needed to raise tax revenue, especially in times of war and with the increasing cost of a professional military establishment. The traditional land taxes, tariffs, tolls, and excises had been stretched to the breaking point. When the British Prime Minister William Pitt was scrambling for revenue to fight the wars against Napoleon, he proposed a property tax that was, in fact, an income tax. It was adopted in 1806. It relied heavily on stoppage, which meant withholding at the source. But there were many difficulties in compliance in that era when the few written records were considered strictly confidential. In fact, if you turn to the Fourth Amendment to our Constitution, which in many respects reflected the rights of Englishmen, look at the Fourth Amendment, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized." So secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. It's awfully hard to collect an income tax under those conditions. And in fact, the British at that time had to resort to establishing committees of men in the same occupation and city, much like the tax farmers, but these were not charged with collecting and keeping the surplus. They were charged with estimating the income for each of their competitors. The British tax was so thoroughly reviled, especially for its highly intrusive implementation, that when the wars ended and the budget stabilized in 1816, the tax was abolished and Parliament voted to destroy all the records. In 1842, however, Prime Minister Robert Peel persuaded Parliament to reinstate the income tax temporarily until the budget was in balance. It has never been repealed. I think a lot of British taxpayers would be happy if they had also kept the initial 3% flat rate. It reached 83% before 1979 with a surcharge of 15% on investment income. The U.S. had a top rate in excess of 90% in the 1950s. That's a marginal rate. And just to give some indication of what that means, there's the old story of the man who went to visit his buddy in Texas, and he went through that big gate that the big Texas ranchers and oil men have up to get onto the long driveway leading up to the house masquerading as a palace. And there he saw his very wealthy friend at the top of a ladder cleaning his gutters. And he hollered up to him, "Why are you cleaning your own gutters? Can't you afford somebody to clean them for you?" The oilman replied, "Sure, but I'd have to pay somebody $100 to get out here to my place and get up here on the ladder and do the cleaning. And in order to pay him $100, I'd have to earn $1,000. So I'd pay the government $900 and have $100 left, and for $1,000 I'll clean my own gutters." So that's what a 90% tax rate means, and that's what the U.S. had in the 1950s. So much for the assertions of E.R.A. Seligman, the great scholar of the income tax and great champion of the income tax, who in his 1914 book said, "The moderate rate, less than or equal to 6%, has been an important factor in the success of the income tax in Great Britain and with respect to Italy. Obviously, an income tax running up to 20%, to which all manner of other kinds of local taxes are to be added, would indeed be unendurable if enforced to the hilt." Well, the U.S. adopted an income tax to finance the Civil War in 1863. The rate was 3% on income exceeding $600, with 5% on income above $10,000. Soon the 5% rate was raised to 10%. Tax expired in 1872 when the revenue was no longer needed. Still, pressure was building for an income tax, and in the first place, enormous accumulations of wealth during the rapid growth of the post-Civil War boom stirred the ire of reformers. Moreover, Lau stresses the growth of the free trade movement. And, you know, this is similar to Peel's situation in 1842 when the British were repealing most of the tariffs. The tariffs in the U.S. had traditionally supported government and the northern manufacturers, but economists always want to get rid of tariffs, and so there was a great movement to repeal tariffs. And but not least of the pressures for the income tax came from the progressive movement with its enthusiasm for direct government action and control of individual behavior, which necessitated a bigger government. An income tax was passed in 1894, but declared unconstitutional. The 16th Amendment was ratified in 1913, so that removed the obstacle, and the income tax was passed right away because wealth is escaping its due share of taxation, according to Seligman. The rates were graduated with a tax of 1% of the first taxable $20,000. You could exempt $3,000, but The first taxable $20,000 was taxed at 1%, and then it increased by 1% steps to a peak of 7% for all taxable income over $500,000. Just to give you some idea, that's equivalent to $11.7 million today. We also got the Federal Reserve System in 1913 to ensure monetary stability, and so the dollar of 1913 would have to be raised to $23 to have equal purchasing power today. So that $500,000 is equivalent to $11.7 million. When Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. opined in 1904 that taxes are what we pay for a civilized society, he was living in a world of 1% tax rates. Is a 40% rate 40 times as civilized? Well, the 16th Amendment gave us the income tax, but it didn't say anything about progressive rates. Progressive rates of the new law were immediately challenged in court as a denial of equality, because the old standards had been equality and uniformity. But the Supreme Court allowed the law to stand. This was a really dramatic change, because legal theory and popular opinion had long supported the idea that taxing everyone, just proportion, equal proportion to income, the biblical tithe, or 10%, was the way to share the cost of government. So in order to understand the sudden prominence of progressive taxation, it's necessary to look at what the economic theorists had been writing. And just pause here for a moment to get the definition straight. Progressive doesn't mean good or bad, it just has a technical meaning here. And a proportional tax is in proportion to the tax base. Let's think about income for the moment. Well, it could be something else, but so it takes 10% of your income regardless of income. That's a proportional tax. A regressive tax takes a higher proportion from people with low income, 20% if your income is $1,000 and 5% if your income is $100,000. That's regressive. And progressive means that as your income goes up, the average percentage taken goes up. So that's how I'm going to be using the word standard economic definition. Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations provides a compendium of the best economic thinking circa 1776. His four maxims of taxation are frequently cited. I'm going to deal only with maxim one. The subjects of every state ought to contribute towards the support of government as nearly as possible in proportion to their respective abilities, that is, in proportion to the revenue which they respectively enjoy under the protection of the state. And so the revenues that they enjoy would be the benefits that they get from being in the state. And their abilities to pay, presumably, is measured by income, if you believe in proportional taxation. But so Smith really slurred over a couple of distinctions in this maxim one, because he made it sound as though both the benefits that the individual receives from the government and his ability to pay are based on, are proportional to income. And that's a question that people have often asked. I mean, who benefits from government? Well, the rich people have a lot of property to protect, so, you know, they maybe should have progressive taxation. But the poor people wouldn't be able to defend themselves in the absence of government, right? I mean, the rich man can hire his own private army, but the poor person is left on the mean streets of the city with no defense. And so he needs government. Well, so, you know, it's by no means clear that either ability to pay or the benefit is proportional to income, but Smith thought it was, and most people did. We're going to be dealing We will not deal any further with benefit side of it, but we're going to look at ability to pay. The strong support for progressive taxes in the economic mainstream originates in two separate but highly related developments in economic theory during the century following the publication of The Wealth of Nations. The first of these is utilitarianism, and the second is the dominance of marginal analysis. Jeremy Bentham, who lived from 1748 to 1832, coined the utilitarian term and adopted the slogan, "The greatest happiness of the greatest number." You may notice that you can't typically do a double maximization in mathematics. You can't do it consistently. But the greatest happiness of the greatest number, but it does convey the sentiment that has motivated most of the subsequent analysis of taxation and public expenditures, including modern cost-benefit analysis. Although he did not use the words, Bentham wrote his utilitarian analysis under the assumption that the marginal utility of income is declining. What this view means is that successive units of income are worth less than the first units. And it seems plausible if you say that the extra dollar that allows the beggar to buy a crust of bread increases his welfare or happiness or utility more than a decrease of a dollar would decrease the utility of Warren Buffett. You may value one bag of carrots or professional tooth cleaning, but the second one that month is worth less to you, and the third even less than that. But is that true for income in general? It is for particular commodities, and that's the diminishing marginal utility argument. Most economists ceased to ask that question after the marginal revolution of 1870. At about the same moment, William Stanley Jevons, writing in English, Leon Walras, writing in French, and Karl Menger, writing in German, adopted marginal analysis, which came to dominate economics and made the concept of decreasing marginal utility of income almost automatic for economists. If we assume that successive units of income have less value, and we assume that everyone is equal with respect to capacity to enjoy income, then the tax implications can be quite dramatic. If the objective is to collect the retired tax revenue while imposing the minimum total sacrifice on society, the appropriate tax is zero up to a certain point and then 100% after that. Take away those dollars that don't give much utility, right? That is, depending on the revenue requirements, the government would set one annual income, for example, $100,000. If you have less than that, you pay no tax. Anything you earn above that is sent directly to the Treasury. Now, of course, most people realized that it was not going to work well, at least not for very long. A few extreme socialists and utopians wanted to believe in it. Indeed, if one accepts the goal not just of minimizing the sacrifice from taxation, but of maximizing the utility of society, why would you not advocate continuing the leveling by transferring money from rich to poor until everyone has the same income? A clever socialist, George Bernard Shaw, in 1928, put it this way: socialism means equality of income or nothing, and that under socialism you would not be allowed to be poor. You would be forcibly fed, clothed, lodged, perhaps we'd add medicated, taught, and employed, whether you liked it or not. If it were discovered that you had not character and industry enough to be worth all this trouble, you might possibly be executed in a kindly manner. But whilst you were permitted to live, you would have to live well. Faced with this logic, most economists retreated slightly to the goal not of maximum utility or minimum sacrifice, but rather to the notion that everyone should endure the same proportional sacrifice of income. Opposition to progressivity was the common position even among the liberal utilitarians of the 19th century. So it took a while for the progressive movement to build out of this, the progressive taxation movement. The opposition was based in part on the fear that progressivity would diminish incentives to work and invest and hence hobble the great engine of economic growth that had done so much to raise the laboring poor to a more comfortable level. Another factor was the fear that breaking the rule of proportionality would lead to continuing efforts to shift all tax burdens to the small minority of the very rich. It is interesting that economists in general were more caught up in the utilitarian notion that the happiness of society could be enhanced by reducing the burdens on the poor, while the lawyers retained the tradition from history and political philosophy that in the absence of firm rules, such as proportional taxation, the problems of faction, as discussed by Madison in Federalist 10, would tear the republic apart or turn it into a tyranny. But John Stuart Mill, who had grown up with utilitarianism, added this caution: to tax the larger incomes at a higher percentage than the smaller is to lay a tax on industry and economy, to impose a penalty on people for having worked harder and saved more than their neighbors. It is not the fortunes which are earned, but those which are unearned, that it is for the public good to place under limitation. Moreover, the income tax relies on self-reporting of income, and thus is, in practice, unequal in one of the worst ways, falling heaviest on the most conscientious. Mill's comments provide a hint of the way out of the morass, but before we follow that trail, let's dig ourselves in deeper. If one accepts the view that the marginal utility of income is diminishing, and one accepts the goal that everyone should sacrifice an equal proportion of his total utility to pay for government, then it's easy to see that rich people should pay more dollars in taxes than should poor people. But does that require a progressive tax on income? It's easy to lapse into that conclusion, but it's incorrect. Briefly, if the loss of a dollar is as painful to a rich man as to a poor, then the equal sacrifice would call for an equal dollar taxation, that is a lump sum tax or a head tax. Each person must pay a tax of, say, $1,000 a year. We usually consider that extreme regressivity. But if the marginal utility of income declines, the rich should pay more. But how quickly would the marginal utility of income have to decrease before equal sacrifice resulted in proportional tax, even in proportional taxation, let alone progressive? This is an interesting math problem that you should solve at your leisure on a rainy morning. And I won't go into it further here. But the main point is we have no way to observe utility, let alone the shape of the marginal utility curve. Moreover, does anyone believe that the relationship between income and happiness is the same for everyone, or even for anyone throughout a lifetime? And we have not even inquired about the relationship between the happiness of one person and what he observes of his neighbors. In particular, if Mr. Smith is altruistic, deriving pleasure from observing that Mr. Knight is wealthy, and Mr. Knight is envious, deriving pleasure from the poverty of his neighbors, the way to improve the total happiness of society is to tax the altruist Smith and give the money to the mean-spirited Knight. Would you vote for that tax? Yet the prevailing economic definition of fairness leans on such weak reeds. In the modern public finance literature, fairness depends on horizontal equity and vertical equity. Vertical equity depends on the degree of progressivity as discussed above. Horizontal equity requires that equals be treated equally. But equals in respect to what? Academic tax specialists and reformers in the U.S. have usually begun with a bias toward a comprehensive definition of income. This amounts to whatever the person consumed during the year plus the net increase in his wealth. So it's all power to consume. And so it doesn't matter what form it comes in: wages, interest, dividends, capital gains, rents, including the rent that an owner occupier should pay for his own house, gifts of cash, securities, goods, services. It would not matter where the power to consume came from or how it was used. It's interesting that famous name around here, Andrew Mellon, who wrote a nice book on taxation in 1934, who was a wealthy investor, Secretary of Treasury for Harding and Coolidge, and generally considered to be an arch conservative, stated, "The fairness of taxing more lightly incomes from wages, salaries, and professional services than the income from business or from investments is beyond question." The actual tax law, of course, is a jumble of special treatment of particular sources and uses of income. Ownership of real estate is heavily favored, as is any investment that generates capital gains. Similarly, on the uses side, medical expenses, gifts to charities, childcare expenses, historic preservation, energy conservation, electric cars, saving for education and retirement are among the favored expenditures. Which is fairer, the comprehensive definition or the tax law definition? Each exception to the comprehensive base for particular sources or uses of income is defended in the name of fairness by its beneficiaries. It matters because it is roughly taxable income rather than comprehensive income that determines who is treated as an equal of whom. And in recent years, there's been a tendency to consider consumption rather than income as the tax base and the fair base for defining equality. The classical reasoning is that consumption measures what a person uses up from the product of the economy, whereas income should be a better measure of what he produces. Well, some of these problems seemed remote prior to 1930, when the federal government took less than 5% of gross domestic product. But with total government spending now exceeding one-third of gross domestic product, including massive redistribution, the warnings about control of a dominant faction to prevent exploitation of the rest of society become more pertinent. In the modern era, economists have continued to analyze the effects of taxation on incentives to earn income and balance these against changes in social utility defined in some unmeasurable way. The philosopher John Rawls in 1971 added the twist of assuming that only the income of the person with the lowest income needed to be a concern of public policy. That is, guide public policy by what it does for that man in rags under the highway bridge who is eating his dinner from a brown paper bag with some liquid in it. He may deserve our compassion, but do we really want to shape the economy and the tax structure to suit him rather than perhaps acting more directly. Anyway, economists and philosophers of the Rawlsian type do not stop to consider the Madisonian question of what will happen to a tax bill of the most sophisticated design when it is submitted to Congress, nor do they consider the possibility that the sovereign is a revenue-maximizing entity at war with his subjects, that is, a stationary bandit. Because of the impossibility of defining a fair tax, it is worth searching for a different approach. The comment by Mill, it is not the fortunes that are earned, but the fortunes that are unearned, provides the starting point. Of course, an income tax becomes totally arbitrary and capricious if the IRS agent has to review your return to judge each receipt for its worthy earnedness. Spare us that intrusion. In fact, it is possible to make a distinction between earned and unearned if we're willing to give up the idea of taxing the individual on his income and turn instead to a tax levied on the source of the unearned income. This does require giving up progressivity, as it is usually defined, because progressivity as a concept applies only to people. The specific alternative to consider is the land value tax, as developed with great vigor and insight by Henry George in his best-selling book, Progress and Poverty, published in 1879. Land value taxation did have its antecedents, but Henry George and those inspired by George have worked out the details most fully. To put the matter in its simplest form, the land value tax would replace other taxes with a single levy on the market value of the land that each person claims title to. Thus, the mechanics are similar to the existing real estate tax used by most local governments and school districts in the U.S. The difference is that the tax would apply only to the value of the land. All buildings and other improvements would be exempt. The market value of land reflects the income you could receive just from holding title to the land. Thus, if you happen to inherit a block of vacant land in the middle of Manhattan or any other thriving city, you could easily lease it to a developer who would do the work of arranging for a building to be built, rented out, and managed. The developer would be compensated for his work, but you could just sit back and enjoy the lease payments. Those payments would be described by an economist as economic rent. The proposed land value tax would be designed to take a substantial portion of that, for example, 90% of the economic rent, but it would be levied as a percentage of the market price of the land so that you could not avoid it by leaving the land idle. You would have a very strong incentive to put the land to work as soon as possible or at the optimum moment and for the optimum use. If you think of imposing a land value tax today while dropping all other taxes, it may seem unfair to those who have just invested their hard-earned savings into a piece of land. That is the transition problem that arises with any change in the tax law. There are winners and losers, and sometimes special transition rules can be adopted to ease the pain. The land value tax is easier to justify if we think of starting with a blank slate before anyone has laid claim to the land. The words of John Locke are the starting point for the analysis of property by many in the classical liberal tradition. Though the earth and all inferior creatures be common to all men, yet every man has a property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. Whatsoever, then, he removes out of the state of that nature has provided and left it in, he has mixed his own labor with and joined to it something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property. It being by him removed from the common state nature has placed it in, it has by this labor something annexed to it that excludes the common right of other men. For this labor being the unquestionable property of the laborer, no man but he can have a right to what that is once joined to, at least where there is enough and as good left in common for others. This analysis has a powerful appeal for the situation where land is a free good. Locke himself noted that significant restriction in the famous closing phrase of the quote, where there is enough and is good left in common for others. When land of a particular quality is no longer a free good, unregulated markets will readily generate annual rental rates for particular parcels, and those annual rates can readily be capitalized into sales prices for parcels that change hands and appraised values for parcels that do not. Land rents, like other prices, can serve to allocate inputs to their most productive uses. The rents are an opportunity cost that must be paid by the user of the land if the economy is to operate efficiently. But who should receive that rent? Henry George argued that the rent should belong to society because it either measures the natural advantage, the God-given advantage of a parcel, that is, superior fertility of soil or location on a natural trade route, or the efforts of other people, highways, ports, and other public infrastructure, the activities of neighbors that attract business to your block, and the growth of population in the community. The opposition to land value taxation often cites the unfairness of taking nearly all the rent, and hence nearly all the value of property and land. Most holders of land today have acquired it in legal and morally defensible ways. That is correct and a serious concern, but there are two sets of counterarguments. Followers of Henry George often argue that even a fully legal land title still leaves the buyer of land as the holder of stolen property. After all, British titles date back to a roving bandit, a French bastard landing with an armed banditti, as Thomas Paine so gently expressed it. U.S. titles generally date to a grant by a European monarch of land that belonged to somebody else. Even in the rare case when a title does not originate in force or fraud, even if it originates in Locke's enclosure from the state of nature, why should that historical accident contribute to the inequality of fortunes today? The set of arguments that I find more convincing, however, relate to the comparison of the land value tax with nearly all other feasible taxes. If the LVT, if the land value tax is theft, it is a one-time problem. The income tax robs people every year of the fruit of their labors. When this moral case is combined with the efficiency and privacy advantages of the land value tax, the case to me seems overwhelming. So rather than arguing about fairness or justice in taxation, let's shift the focus toward the one tax base that has a well-defined market value based on opportunity cost, that is, what the market determines to be the rent of land. The focus can then shift away from the utilitarian pseudoscience of minimizing unobservable sacrifices and maximizing unseen utilities, or pretending that we can say anything about the fairness of taking from one person to give to another. To quote Frank Chowderoff, taxation is highwaymanry made respectable by custom, thievery made moral by law, while the land value tax just allows the community to reclaim the value that it has produced using explicit and open market data rather than the tax inquisitors that some consider to be worse than the roving bandits. Thank you.